Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Human language is overwhelmingly organic, grown up over eons on the plains and deserts and mountainsides of the world. English, Arabic, Kickapoo, Chinese. But for hundreds of years at least, humans have been deliberately inventing languages as well. 900 invented languages in 900 years. They have not fared well. But they tell a fascinating story of human longing and aspiration. This hour, On Point, inventing language. You can join the conversation. Are you one of those who longs for something better, something different? Esperanto, Klingon, Hoikoi, Latini? What do invented languages tell us about human longing, aspiration, frustration? Do you feel trapped by your mother tongue? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Philadelphia is Erica Okrent, linguist and author of the new book, In the Land of Invented Languages, Esperanto Rock Stars, Klingon Poets, Logland Lovers, and the Mad Dreamers Who Tried to Build a Perfect Language. Erica Okrent, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
This is just terrific. What a wonderful story. Who knew 900 languages in 900 years? And before we go one step further, I want to hear, if you'd be so kind as to let me dive in, just a couple of them, Erica. Here's a little bit from J.R.R. Tolkien. He wrote a poem called Namarie, also called Galadriel's Lament for the Fellowship of the Ring, Book 2. Here he is himself reading in his Elvish.
I laurie lantar lassi surine, inyar un notti narve ramar alron. In yarve linti yulmar vanier mior marge lissi miru voriva, andunne pella vardo telmar nulluini jassen tintelari eleni, o Mario aeritari.
Tolkien reading his own there, sweet mead in lofty halls, and off he goes in Elvish. It kind of trips right off the tongue. Not all of these do. In Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, Christopher Plummer, played by the Shakespeare, quoting Klingon General Chang. Here he is making a half attempt at diplomacy with the despised Federation of Planets in Klingon.
Ta, ha, ko, nosh, wa, dach, bach, ta, dach, wa, nosh.
That Enterprise fired on Kronos 1 without provocation.
Okay, not exactly melodious, Erica, but there's this fascination, and it just goes on and on. You're right. I was amazed at the depth of this history. You remind us, you're a linguist. You remind us that the job of the linguist is to describe languages, usually the organic old-time ones, in all their messy glory, and try to figure out what they can teach us about life and the workings of the human mind. If that's the job of the linguist when it comes to natural languages or organic languages? What's the job when it comes to invented languages?
Typically linguists have looked down on the practice of inventing languages because it's very presumptuous. When you study language for a living and you realize just how complex and complicated it is and how little we understand, when you see someone come along and say, hey, I have a great idea for a language.
I can make one up. Yeah,
you think, you have to, if you think you can do better than nature, then you clearly don't know very much about how it works naturally. It's like if you were a vision biologist and studying the eyeball for years and years, and then someone came up and said, hey, I think I could invent a better eyeball where you could see around walls and see through things. And, that would just be sort of insulting to the person who's been studying the eyeball
the real
for
deal.
Years.
Remind us then, maybe the place to start is, I mean, just in linguist terms, how organic languages came to be. Where did English come from? Where did Chinese come from? What's the sort of, broadly speaking, what was the process by which we got these languages?
Well, we can't look and see exactly where it started, but we know from seeing dialects and jargon and slang develop that language grows naturally. Somebody says something, someone else picks up on that way of saying it, and over time, as it becomes entrenched into a habit, it becomes a system. And this is how natural languages grow. No one ever sat down with a pen and paper to write Russian or the rules of French. They happened over time.
But it clearly, if you go all the way back, I mean, these were, I don't know, grunts and gestures plus grunts and everything else that turned into language. Again, setting us up to understand invented language, why would it be that organic languages are so very different? Linguists must have looked at the human mind. It's obviously very diverse in the way it's prepared to articulate the world.
Yeah, there are infinite and wonderful way, or perhaps not infinite, but many wonderful differences between languages and the ways you can say things. And by looking at that and seeing what the limits are on what human languages do, we can also figure out how the human mind wants to work and in communication. So we hope by studying natural languages that we can figure out what the parameters of language as a possibility are for humans.
So what kind of mind or frames of mind then leads people to reject all those organic languages? If you don't like your own, there are plenty of others out there, and go to invented. Has there been a profile or the sort of set of motivations behind making them up?
Well, typically through the history, it's been a dissatisfaction with natural language. So you look at natural language, it's kind of an engineering disaster. We often have the sense that we can't say exactly what we mean to say, that we're trapped, our thoughts are trapped, and we can't get them into our language, or we've got irregular verbs, we've got two words that mean one thing and one word that means multiple things, and languages have all these inconsistencies and ambiguities, and you know, we can fly to the moon and build submarines. Why can't we build a better language? This is what people have been trying to do for centuries.
900 in 900 years. I was astonished by that number. That's somebody out there almost every year, yeah, on average, trying to come up
with
a new one.
And those are only the ones we know about.
take us back to the first one that we know about.
Mm-hmm. Well, the earliest records we have for an invented language are from Hildegard von Bingen, a 12th century German nun, who created this manuscript of a very large vocabulary of items in the natural world and in related to the church and things in her life, just a little bit of translation. And it's unclear exactly what the purpose of this language was. Scholars have suggested that it might have been a secret language to be used with her nuns, or some sort of speaking in tongues, divine inspiration. But there appears to be more thought put into it than just a, you know, bubbling out of divine inspiration. The fact that it was set down on paper and there's some system to some of the endings on the words makes it seem like she was the first Conlanger, as we call the constructed language producers, who do it for artistic reasons, to define the world around them in a way that they think language should do.
But it clearly didn't catch on. And the other striking thing about this number of 900 in 900 years is that almost none of them catch on. Why do you think such a dismal track record for invented languages?
Well, often when someone sets out to invent a language, they think about the properties of the language and perfecting the characteristics of the language, but they don't think very much about how to get people to speak it. So they focus on the product, I guess, without thinking about the marketing. And we know from natural language, it's very hard to convince people to speak a language. They don't necessarily do it for practical reasons. We like to think language is a tool that we pick up like a hammer in order to do a job, to communicate. But it's actually a lot more than that. We don't just take our thoughts, wrap them up in a box, send them along, and let the other person unwrap them. Language helps us identify with each other. It's a way of formulating our thoughts, not just passing them on. And the language inventors have perhaps focused too much on the properties of the tool rather than the fact that language lives within a society of people.
You're one of those people who picks languages up easily, and your mind, we'll talk about why, but your mind has turned to invented languages. You actually studied Klingon and some Esperanto, but Klingon, I think you got some kind of certificate in Klingon. You can do that?
Yes, there's the Klingon Language Academy, which oversees the language and administers a certification exam, which has three levels. And I initially went into the world of Klingon as a, you know, impartial scientist. I was going to take some notes and observe what happens. But when I found out that it was this interesting, tricky puzzle, I got swept up by it. I thought, I can do this. I can pass the exam. And so I went ahead. I took that first level one, but I haven't gone any further than that. So I'm a low-level certified Klingon speaker, yeah.
And Esperanto as well, you've gone into that world. That's one that does have its speakers and followers. We'll talk about the culture they've created. You've learned a few lines in that one as well. We're going to go to a break here in just a second, but can you... I think you can say, thank you for listening. Please stay with us in Esperanto. Would you share that kindly with us?
You would say, Dankon por ausculti. Bonvolu resti kun ni.
Esperanto speakers, that's for you, and it's for everybody else as well. We've got a lot more we're going to dive into here with Erica Okrent. We'll go out with We Will Rock You in Klingon. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about invented languages, from Esperanto to Klingon to Boabamu, if I've got that right, and what they tell us about human longing and aspiration. Erica Okrent is with us from Philadelphia, a linguist. She's author of the new book, In the Land of Invented Languages. She's looked deeply at the history of the 900 languages, maybe more, invented in the last 900 years, and it's really something. Jack, in Newport News, Virginia, you're on. Jack, hi.
Hey, how are you, Tom and Ms. O'Cran? Thank you very much. This is a wonderful subject. I was especially intrigued by your comment about how real linguists don't really think of these traditional languages having their own sort of things that are made up, like dialects. I'm very good at German, and in Germany we have all kinds of dialects. Everybody gets bent out of shape, though, if you don't speak high German, unless they're like your neighborhood buddies. I've always been intrigued by artificial languages, and I was thinking that one that wasn't mentioned was Professor Bob Barker from Minnesota. He invented an artificial language called Solyani, which he used in a lot of the things that he wrote. He's almost as impressive as what Tolkien has done. I think he's still alive. I hope he is. He's a great, great linguist himself. I believe he was an Urdu and Hindi scholar.
And Jack, I see a note here that says that you not only speak German, but you're pretty good at Klingon. Is that true?
Yes, I am.
So what do you like to say in Klingon first thing in the morning or whenever?
Well, you know, I'm a human being, so what I always think is that I've had to change Klingon around because, you know, Klingons don't say things like thank you or nice to see you, but I have heard them say kalech nes.
Is that repeatable in English?
Nice to see you, yeah.
Okay.
Thank you is something I made up, which is bololach. And I found out that Ms. O'Krand is not related to Mark O'Krand, the guy that created it.
Yeah. Well, we've decided we're distant cousins of some sort. We haven't verified the link, but
a little different spelling, but it sounds very close. Hey, Jack, you're great. Thanks for calling. We've got a lot to get to, but what about Klingon itself and Mark O'Krand and the origin? I mean, who made this up? Why?
Well, Mark O'Krand is a linguist that was hired by Paramount to create the language for the third Star Trek movie. There had been a little Klingon in the first movie. That was created by James Doohan, the actor who played Scotty. And when they were putting together the third movie, there was going to be a lot more Klingon in it, and they hired him to work out a more extensive language. And he did it in a way so that he could keep track of what he was doing as he was doing it. So he had to make a system so that when he had to translate things, he could sort of look back at his dictionary and his grammar and figure out how to say them. And then this dictionary and grammar became the basis of the language, and it was published, and people started to learn it, and it took on a life of its own.
So there you go, a language almost ordered up by a movie studio. We've got a question on this front, Erica, from Jessie on Twitter. She says, how many of the 900 languages are to entertain, like Elvish or Klingon, and how many to improve human language, like Esperanto?
Well, the majority would be to improve, but only because there's so much more history than there is the present day languages, of which there are very many, too many to count, many that go out just on the internet, that come and go. But the purpose today, I would say, you know, from the 80s onward, has been to create to satisfy an artistic vision. So languages like Tolkien's and many of the hobby conlanger languages that come up today are people thinking, what if we had a language that had only vowels? How would that work? Or what if we had a language that worked with it was an octopus with tentacles? Could you make a language just using that, a sort of signal language? And so these are ideas, creative ideas, and people figuring out artistic problems by inventing a language. And there are many of those today, but I would say through the history, it's been to change language. But that hasn't been successful. And if you're doing it to fit your artistic vision, then your basis for success is much more likely to be met.
Or personal satisfaction, maybe. Yeah. And they just keep coming. I mean, I'm looking here through the 90s and into the 2000s, Verdurian and Rikchik and Tokana and Megdevi and Tokiponan. Who knew? You describe some broad periods or trends in creation. You look back at the 17th century when people were looking for a kind of very universal, rational language where words would perfectly express concepts. John Wilkins, give us a sense of what he was up to.
Well, the 17th century was this exciting time for science and computation. Latin was sort of on the way out as a lingua franca, and mathematical notation was making great strides, and people were making these discoveries in calculus, and they saw mathematical notation had this potential to be a universal language, that it wouldn't just be a universal mode of communication, but it could actually make you think more rationally. You could put a sentence into a sort of proof and figure out the truth of things. And so Wilkins devised this massive, he was a founding member of the Royal Society, involved in scientific life of the day, and he set out to create such a language, and it ended up being this massive 600-page tree diagram of every concept in the universe organized into categories. And this massive work then burned up in the Great Fire of London, and he had to do it all over again, which he did. So it was this tremendous piece of work that never ended up taking off as a language, but it did sort of form a basis for the thesaurus, which is what happens when you categorize concepts. It's a brilliant piece of work on the meaning of words in English in the 17th century, but it was, as a language, it was impossible to use. You have to know exactly what you want to say before you say anything in Wilkins' language.
And when you look back as a linguist on that magnificent obsession, what does it tell you about, I mean, here's a brilliant guy. He tried to do something outside natural language. It didn't work out. What do we learn from his experiment?
Perhaps we can't have a perfect rational language. When we speak, we're often figuring out what we want to say as we're speaking. And if we have to sit down and figure out the truth of things before we can utter a sentence, then no one will be able to say anything. You can do a little with this language, but it's not flexible enough for the vast range of things that we do with language in a daily manner.
Or maybe we're too imperfect for a perfectly rational language in the way we
probably
think and imagine. Let's go to Eric in Southbridge, Massachusetts. Eric, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, I just heard Erica mention mathematics, and I was very privileged to know the guy who invented the language Numato, a guy named Ivor Darrig. And his idea was exactly that you could speak a mathematical language so that there would be a single word for the concept raised to the power of. And it was filled with all kinds of squeaks and grunts and clicks, but it was truly amazing. And he published the Journal of Numato for some years as one of his many other pursuits. I should say that we shouldn't forget this guy. He was one of the founders of micro harmonic instruments, and he was an early pioneer in electronic instruments. I was in his somewhat famous laboratory, and he had absconded with some racks full of relays from the phone company, and he wired it up to a keyboard, and you could play these tens of thousands of relays in the most amazing way.
But when you say, Eric, that it was a language math-based, but it sounds, with your description of a single word for raised to the power of, that was kind of a language for mathematicians that would allow mathematicians to speak more efficiently to one another.
In a way it was, I suppose, but it was the silliest thing one ever heard, of course, and it was, it has to be counted among languages. It was very complex and had a vocabulary that would enable you to see a complex formula and just speak it, which was quite remarkable.
Numado. Erica, what do you know about it?
Yeah, well, that sounds a lot. There's a similar language called Loglan, which was spoken logical notation. So in logic, you say things like, exists an X such that X is so-and-so. And in Loglan, the language of logic, you can express these logical formulae with vocabulary that was developed to represent that kind of thing. So these are... It's sort of notations are developed so you can so you don't have to express math in English paragraphs as they had to do hundreds of years ago. You can write it in an equation, and this is sort of going back to taking that equation then and making it speakable. So it's an interesting cycle in the purpose of inventing languages.
If Numado was kind of for mathematicians, you write about other invented languages that were for particular groups. In one case, a language for a gender, a language deliberately invented for women. Tell us about it.
This was Ladan, invented by Suzette Hayden Elgin, who's a science fiction author and a linguist herself. And she began to wonder whether you could build a language that would better reflect the perceptions of women. So she created vocabulary, like there's a word for non-holiday, a time allegedly a holiday, but actually so much a burden because of work and preparations that's a dreaded occasion, especially when there are too many guests and none of them help.
Women know that, and there's no English word for that.
Right. There's no single word for that concept. She developed vocabulary like that. But also a grammar where you have to express the intention of your sentence before you say it. So this means that if somebody says something and you say, hey, if you take it as an insult, the person can't say, I was just kidding. The burden was on them to make that explicit at the beginning of their sentence, not on the hearer for taking it the wrong way. So these are some of the ways in which she built a language for women's perceptions.
Are there many of these 900 whose creators are looking maybe not to get away from irregularities of expression or engineering disasters, as you put it, but the kind of political release of some kind? I mean, she's got in her Ladan, she has a word for to menstruate joyfully or to menopause uneventfully, men unlikely to have made those up. I mean, natural languages, I would think, would be co-created by men and women, but she thought it was not friendly enough to women. Are many of these invented languages attempts to escape a political framework?
Well, many languages have sought to make it harder for language to manipulate people. So you can use language for nefarious purposes, propaganda, to convince people of truths that aren't true. This is how in the period after the Second World War, people were concerned about this, that the use of Nazi propaganda was an abuse of language, and how could we escape from that? And this led to some symbol languages where you could avoid words by using symbols, and therefore you wouldn't be able to manipulate people because they would be able to look at the symbols and see the truth of things.
But you also couldn't speak, or could you speak that symbolic language?
Some of them also had a spoken form, but the most successful one, Bliss Symbolics, was just a symbol language. And, of course, you can manipulate people just as well with symbols or pictures or any mode of communication, but he was under the impression that he could sort of save the world through his symbol language. He was a difficult character, and he worked so hard all his life to get recognized, sending it out to all the universities in the world, all the heads of government, never got any attention until a school in Canada for children with cerebral palsy began to use it to help the children who couldn't speak transition into reading. So they started with his symbols. And in the beginning, he was overjoyed. He had finally been recognized, the worth of his project noticed, but quickly began to complain about the way they were using it and ended up threatening lawsuits and sort of ruining the recognition that he had always hoped for by interfering too much.
You write about Benjamin Whorf, who, amateur linguist, I guess, 19th century, who saw language as a kind of a trap defining our culture, wanted to break free of that. What about him and his school?
Well, Whorf was a linguist who studied Native American languages and noticed that their modes of expression were very different from European languages. And he wrote many papers sort of suggesting a link between the way you think and the language you speak. And he died before he got a chance to fully explore this thesis, but it was turned by other scholars into something called the Whorf hypothesis, which sort of crudely and simply put is that the language you speak influences the way you think. And language inventors have been interested in that question. Notably, the feminist language Ladan was designed to see whether people could speak in this women's perspective language. Would they then change their perspective? And also Logland, the logical language, was designed to see whether if people could speak in logic, would they then think more logically? Neither of the languages have resolved the Whorf hypothesis, and it creates a lot of debate to this day.
As a linguist, do linguists see some natural languages as more or less conceptually confining than others? Do you look around and say, well, you know, this language you can think pretty freely in, and this language is awfully restrictive? Do you look at languages that way?
People have that have their preferences when it comes to language, but really, all languages are capable of expressing the things that humans want to express. Some languages make it easier to express certain concepts, but none of them make it impossible. So it's very hard to say that your language is trapping your mind. People do the things with language that they need to do, and you can always find a way to translate between languages.
We're talking with Erica Okrent. Her new book is In the Land of Invented Languages. We'll go out with Esperanto Desperado here, playing Festeno, means feast in Esperanto. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about invented languages, from Esperanto to Klingon. Well, right on down a very long list, 900 in the last 900 years, my guest Erica Okrent tells us. Her new book is In the Land of Invented Languages, Esperanto Rock Stars, Klingon Poets, Logland Lovers, and the Mad Dreamers Who Tried to Build a Perfect Language. Michael in Boston, you're on the air with Erica Okrent.
Thank you. I was wondering, Erica, what's your opinion on Dr. John Dee's Enochian language from the 1500s is? It was supposedly received from a spirit medium, but I've read accounts from linguists that say it has quite a bit of internal consistency. I'm wondering what your familiarity with that subject is.
Erica, Dr. John Dee and Enochian?
Yes, the language of the angels. It's considered one of these glossolalia languages. So he took divine inspiration to create this language. I don't know much about about it having a systematic nature, it could quite possibly be one of these that were intended to dignify a sort of vision of what language should be, although in this case it's a vision imparted from above or from the spirit world.
And one of 900. Brad in Charlotte, North Carolina, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, this is Brad from Charlotte.
Hi.
Weird thing, whenever I heard the show, I had to call in, never called in before. When we were teenagers, I'm 31 now, there was a language that was taught by one of my friend's mothers that said that she invented it in college. But then as I've traveled the world, I've realized that people know it all over the world, and it's called gibberish. It's based on the English language, and it's broken down into syllables.
But are you pulling our leg? I mean, gibberish is just nonsense, isn't it? Or...
Actually, it's called gibberish. I know that gibberish by definition
it's a pig Latinesque family.
Okay.
But it's way faster, and it's actually more cryptic.
So give us a little sample, Brad?
Yeah, tell me something to say, and I'll say it.
Hi, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Join us. Okay, so pig. I mean, there's kind of a formula, and pretty soon you take anything and turn it into gibberish. Erica, does this count?
Well, this is sort of a re-encoding of an existing language. So things like pig Latin or gibberish or ubby dubby. There's another one where you sort of perturb the natural language that's existing. And use it to, you know, make a secret language so your kids can't understand you or your parents can't understand you. I don't get so much into that because they're not intentional, worked out grammars. They might as well be English or the language that you're starting with in an encoded form.
Pretty highly encoded there, downright encrypted.
Yeah.
Brad, thanks for calling. I mean, you write wonderfully. You say the history of invented languages for the most part a history of failure. And that they were fueled by vain dreams of fame and recognition or by humble hopes that the world could be made a better place through language or most often by a combination of the two. Introduce us to some of the more colorful dreamers and idealists in this among these 900, Erica.
Well, one very interesting language was Sol Re Sol, which is a language based on the notes of the musical scale. So Do Re Mi Fa Sol and Sol Re Sol is the word for language. This one actually had a bit of popularity around the 1830s. The inventor Soudre traveled all over Europe, putting on performances in this language, playing it on the violin.
It was a sung language, a musical language.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You could sing it. You could play it on an instrument. You could even. It's just based on seven steps on the musical scale, so you could use seven colors to represent it, or your seven fingers. So you could do many different sorts of performances with it, which made it a hit on the stage, but not so much as a language. It was one of these sort of philosophical language ideas where all words. For a certain category or concept or area started with the same syllable. It was a bit hard to use, but it made for a great show.
And then you've got examples of people not really inventing languages, but coming close, pulling languages out of deep, deep time. Hebrew as an example of this, a language that, whose spoken form was almost gone outside of liturgy and Talmudic teaching, and then reinvigorated to become the language of a whole country, Israel.
Yeah, modern Hebrew is a sort of very unique success story because there's language revival movements all over, like the Irish example, trying to bring languages back to life that just don't seem to work very well. You can't convince people to speak a language they don't speak, even if they have an emotional attachment to it. But modern Hebrew, Hebrew was not spoken by anyone as their native home language when... the Zionists in the late 19th century went to try to establish a new community, and one visionary, Eliezer ben Yehuda, decided that he was going to bring it back, starting with his own home, and he only spoke Hebrew with his son and thus created the first native speaker in a couple thousand years. And there was the language hadn't disappeared. The people used it for religious purposes. It was also a sort of lingua franca in the region among people of different language backgrounds. But he turned it back into a living native home language that's spoken by millions of people today.
Pretty incredible accomplishment. Let's get a call from Fitchburg, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Hi. It occurs to me that we could put several things together. Babies can learn three languages and keep them clear in their heads. Mm. If every baby, through a TV program, you know, Sesame Street or something, mm-hmm. learned something like Logland along with English or French or whatever, everyone would have as a second language a language in common, and we'd all get to be closer to one big family.
You mean if we tried this globally...
Yes.
And why an invented language rather than some extant language as the universal, David?
Well, I think maybe Logland's whole intent was to be the second language, but universally held. The point was that if you had a language that was natural, the people who were born in it would have a certain advantage.
So bring on an invented language, try to make it universal, and maybe there comes world peace. That is not an uncommon impulse, Erica, as you describe the history of these languages.
No, and, you know, this even Esperanto actually has native speakers. So people who, you know, meet at an Esperanto conference and the mother is Polish and the father is Danish, their language in common in is Esperanto. And when they have children, their language of the home is Esperanto. And there's a few hundred native Esperanto speakers out there. So it can be naturalized into a native language. Logland is a little harder because it's much harder for the parents to serve as a language model. There aren't enough fluent speakers to make that happen. And it's also been tried with Klingon. There's a guy who raised his son with only Klingon for the first couple years of his life. But then the son started refusing to actually use it. He's a very nice young man now.
Right. What do you think of the idea? What have you come to think of the idea of that aspiration for world peace through a common language, perhaps an invented language? What does Esperanto tell you about the odds of that or the possibility?
Well, Esperanto's done about as well as any language invented language ever has, but it's still not a universal language. You just can't convince people to do it because it's a good idea. You know, it's in the abstract. Abstract reasons don't convince people to do the work that it takes to learn a language. But if you have other reasons, if you want to participate in something or you find other people that share your interests who also do that language, then you might do it. And this is how Esperanto has formed a sort of community of Esperanto speakers, not a whole world community, but one where people can share other interests besides just language, but they can use the language in which to do that with.
It may not have taken over, but it's a real community. You went out and dipped into it. What did you find about the culture created around this invented language, Esperanto?
Well, it's interesting because there's the idea that it should be this neutral language for the world, but they're definitely developed these little in-group ways of talking. So if you're speaking Esperanto, you can say, you know, you can use textbook Esperanto where you say, la cielo estas blua, the sky is blue. But if you really want to be Esperanto, you say, la cielo bluas, turning blue into a verb, because you can do that in Esperanto. And if you're doing that, then you're being a little bit more Esperanto-y. So that shows there's an actual culture to the language. It's not this neutral thing out there, although you can use it in a neutral fashion and be well understood.
You remind us that the creator of Esperanto, Ludwig Zamenhof, really wanted it to enable peace. Do you see that in the culture today, the microculture of Esperanto?
So he was motivated. He saw all this strife caused by nationalism around him. People spoke different languages, didn't get along. And he thought it would be good if we had a neutral meeting ground. So when For example, today, when I go out as an English speaker into the world and I speak English in another country, then I've got a little, there's a power imbalance. It's my native language, mm-hmm. but it's not the other person's native language. And Esperanto speakers today are very conscious of that, of those kind of imbalances and meeting each other on neutral ground. And there is this nice sort of internationalism to the community. It's not peace for the whole world, but it's nice people who are concerned about peace going out there and interacting with people from other cultures and knowing them in a way where there isn't this power imbalance.
Let's get a call from Milo in Scituate, Rhode Island. Hi, Milo, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you?
Okay, what do you know?
I became interested in language 45 years ago when I became a computer programmer. And I remember reading a book about how language influences us. And there was a mention about how the Welsh language actually divides the color spectrum differently than other languages do. So that, I was wondering if that doesn't actually affect how we not only think, but the way we see the world. You know, if our words determine so much that
way. Erica, how about it? Is there a new world out there waiting to be perceived if only we could break into another language, an invented language?
Yeah, this goes back to this sort of Worf question of what does a language do to the way you see the world? And there's been a huge psycholinguistic literature on color naming and what effects it has. And, people who only have, who have two words for colors, there are languages that only have black and white for all colors, are grouped under one of those categories.
Wow.
They can still perceive colors when you do tests with them. But there may be more subtle effects which have to be drawn out with much more complicated experiments to your vocabulary for things that you can perceive. But certainly this has been something that language inventors have tried to puzzle out what kind of vocabulary should I make in order to define the world as I want my language to see it. And it's a very interesting creative question when people do that. But it's a very fraught and sticky question in reality, and it hasn't been resolved.
What have you come to think at the end or deep in your studies here? I mean, might there be a better way of living, seeing the world, perceiving the cosmos that we're cut off from by the languages that we've received, or these, because they've evolved naturally, are the best we can do?
Well, my journey through invented languages what it did for me was deepen my appreciation for natural languages and the huge range of things that natural languages let us do. So these perfect languages, they might make things more clear or more logical, but there's a lot that's very, very difficult to say in them that's very easy to say in a natural language. And we can be very specific and constrained when we need to be, such in legal language or other sort of jargons that let us be very particular and specific. Or we can be loose and sloppy and messy. And far from that, that's not necessarily a drawback of language, because it allows us to do things like thought formulation as we speak, and it allows us to form bonds with other people when we're not even really saying, we're not even communicating information. We're just kind of talking to talk, mm-hmm. and that lets us do social things. So it's given me a deeper respect for natural languages and what they can do. But I do admire some of these dreamers who took these ideas and really followed through with them, because we all have fleeting moments of, you know, wouldn't it be nice to have a language like this, or Chinese characters make a better language, and then we don't think anything more about it. But But these people have sat down and done the hard work of trying to figure it out. And though they don't succeed, their efforts can answer a lot of questions for us and make us see natural languages more clearly.
Well, it's a remarkable history. Who knew? 900 invented languages in 900 years. And you tell it very well. Your enthusiasm is really infectious, Erica. Thank you so much for being with us this hour. And thanks for the new book. It's In the Land of Invented Languages. Erica Okrent in Philadelphia, thank you very much for joining us. It's been great.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll go out with a little more Esperanto. This is Alberta Casey in Esperanto singing, as you hear, Send in the Clowns. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us. Kia